Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang, where we will be continuing with our discussion on the book Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba, authored by Dr. John Hislop. I think this is our 70th episode or so doing the same, and as in each and every episode, once again we shall go through the amazing things discussed between Swami and Hislop and others, and because these are all recordings of interviews, it is always very interesting and enticing, in the sense that we don't know what's coming next. What comes up next could be a story, it could be something casual in quotes about something happening around, or it could be a profound truth that is being showered. So that is the anticipative joy, that is the joy of unexpectedness that we enjoy as we go through this book. And I'm sure that as we go through it today, you too will enjoy the same. The variety of topics that are discussed there, and the depth of the topics, and the kind of questions that arise in the minds of people then. I'm saying then because these conversations are at least 40 to 50 years old. It just shows that questions remain the same. The different people come on the face of earth and keep asking the same questions over and over again. And it's amazing. Hats off to Swami, hats off to God, to be the ever patient one, answering the same questions again and again and again, be it when Arjuna asked it or when we are sitting here and asking it in the Kurukshetra of our lives, in the battlefield of our lives. Last week we had seen how Bhagwan had delivered a private discourse to all the Jewish devotees who had assembled at Vrindavan. And towards the end of that very enlightening discourse, Swami permitted all the Jewish devotees to conduct their festival of lights, Hanukkah, which comes a fortnight or so before Christmas. So Hanukkah is the festival of lights lasting for 10 days, and they requested Swami whether they could decorate the entire ashram, and Swami agreed for it. He also agreed to light the first lamp on the day one of the festival, and that is where we had concluded. Today we will continue from then on. Again, it's a new conversation, and in this conversation there are other participants along with Hislop. Last time we had a Jewish participant, most probably Michael Goldstein, because it was given as MGMG, a person of the Jewish faith. Today we have another person. So all that is lined up today, but before we go into that, let's welcome Brother Prem to the satsang. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind, and Sairam to all our listeners. As you rightly said, many of these questions are repetitive, not only from other devotees. We can see that even Hislop is kind of reconfirming, re-questioning, or reposing some of the questions that he has already asked. And the beauty with Swami is no conversation is frivolous, no conversation is light. And I'm sure few years later, if we come back to these same conversations, we ourselves will derive new insight from it as we progress in this understanding of ours. Hopefully we are progressing, you know, as the years pass. It's not just the graying of the hair and increase in the age. We do hope that we are growing closer to Swami also in this journey, and as that happens, we will find newer insights into this. And this opportunity of the lockdown, or we all being grounded in our own ways, is giving us an opportunity to listen to a lot of people in the form of these new satsangs. So many old students, so many devotees are speaking, and in each conversation that they've had, they are reflecting on conversations they've had with Swami many, many decades ago, and their new insights in the changed circumstances, given that Swami is not physically available now, what it means to them. Given their life experiences, what it means to them. And I think that is why it's so important to cherish each of these conversations, be it in person with Swami or even in dreams. I mean, not necessarily be shared with everybody, but I think one needs to treasure every one of these conversations. Anywhere, if you feel that there is a touch of Swami, it could even be a mere coincidence of somebody coming and telling you something, at that point, which is very profound, which is very touching. I think all of that matters, because all of that will be the treasure you turn back to. Just like how any bank balance or any treasure that your parents or your ancestors give you is something that you fall back on difficult times. I think these are all treasures that you can fall back on times when you really need it emotionally.
And it's also very important to cherish them, because we are what we think. You know, dust we think, dust we are, God we think, God we are. Now, dust and God are the two extremes. Most of us fall somewhere in between. And that in between too is not a fixed place. We keep going up and down the scale, if I can say so. So, the more we cherish these beautiful episodes, these beautiful moments, that is what will remain predominantly with us, you know. Something amazing happens which really touches our heart. It is so beautiful. If we forget to record it or write it down or put it in some manner so that we can recollect it at a future time, it just becomes one among the several such incidents, several incidents happening in our day. For example, if, you know, this was a question that Arjuna had asked Krishna about how Krishna knows everything about everybody. And Krishna says, Arjuna, do you remember your marriage with Subhadra, right?
Subhadra.
Yes, Subhadra. Okay. And Arjuna is able to recollect every little detail. And Krishna says, do you remember 4 days back, or I don't know, 5 days back, whatever, in the afternoon at this time, what were you doing? And Arjuna is thinking, four days back, what was 4 days back? What was in the afternoon? He's just not able to recollect. And Krishna says, how is it, Arjuna, that you are recollecting something that happened years ago, but something that happened a few days ago, you're not able to remember? He says, Krishna, that was my marriage. How can anybody forget their wedding day? Krishna says, see, you're interested. When you have interest, you remember that, and that remains with you always. When you're not interested, it just goes away, though you have experienced it the same way as the other one. I just feel, you know, extrapolating that is what it is. Krishna answers there saying that, you know, I am keenly interested in everything that happens to everybody in every part of the universe. That's why I know everything about everybody. My takeaway from that was, if I cherish and remember things that have touched my heart, are so beautiful, are so positive, are so full of divinity, just like Arjuna being able to remember his wedding, when we look back at our lives, we will remember these points rather than the pain points. If we keep focusing on our pain, on our misery, on our unhappiness over and over and over again, finally when we look back at our life will be a collection of all pain points only, because that is what we have remembered and not exactly cherished, but repeatedly fed ourselves. So that is why from this perspective as well, it becomes so important that we cherish the good moments, the divine moments, those moments when our heart felt light, those moments when we felt uplifted. In fact, that is what satsang is all about. That is the reason you will be feeling very dreary, weary and horrible and hopeless and not interested in doing anything. But then a satsang begins and 10-15 minutes into the satsang, you start feeling better already, because you have started focusing on those beautiful moments. So from the perspective of them being eternal, as you said, and from the perspective of they defining who we are now, from both these perspectives, it is very important that we cherish good moments, beautiful moments, and make it a habit from now on. You know, anything beautiful happens, yes, share it to, if not to others, if it's personal, share it to yourself multiple times, write it down, record it and keep it. Record not just the event that happened, but all your feelings associated with it. Because, you know, we can possibly store a sight as a photograph, we can store some sound as a video, but to store the feelings, we don't have technology yet. And that is why that task has to be entrusted to the heart.
And talking about Swami having interest in everybody and everything, and so knowing and remembering everything, I think that's the theme of the first question that is being asked here. And it's a very interesting one. I'm sure for some of us, it might appear a little inappropriate, because we have already placed Swami in that position of the divine, omniscient one. But for those who have interacted with Swami, I think this is not a very off question to ask. Mm-hmm. Because you've seen Swami in all those colors of being very human, being childlike, being suddenly raising himself to the level of the Supreme Being, that it stuns you in that moment. You really become thoughtless. So given somebody who has interacted with Swami like that, this question is not inappropriate or out of place, because Hislop asks, I have asked important people around Sai if Sai is all-knowing at all times or only when he so chooses. They give different answers. The very fact that this question Hislop thought about, and he is also saying that different people give different answers, I think it itself shows the amount of confusion in the number of in the minds of the people who have been with Swami too.
Absolutely. And in reply, Swami says, Sai knows everything. The people are in doubt due to the maya of the avatar. You know that Sai is in your heart, yet you think, is Sai upstairs in his room or is he elsewhere? It is a human element. The body has the name of Hislop, but you are not the body, you are the Atma or the spirit. So Swami says that all this doubt comes because of the maya of the avatar. You know, when Swami was physically there itself, people have wondered, is Swami here? Is Swami really there? Is Swami really in charge? And especially now when Swami is physically not there, I think this question becomes even more, haunting or pestering. You know, you see things happening possibly in a way that it shouldn't. And you wonder whether, you know, Swami is really there or not. Is God really there? Is justice being served? What is this happening? You know, I was just thinking about this, and I came across an experience that has been documented by Diana Baskin.
Mm-hmm.
She came to Swami, I think, in the late 1970s, and she has written a book called Divine Memories with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. And I've been trying hard to get a copy of that book, because that book, it doesn't contain many of these lo and behold miracles, you know. It contains the beautiful relationship between the Lord and the devotee. A devotee who is just like a housewife, and, you know, her problems, her thinkings are all very commonplace. Like, you can so well associate with it. And there are very few lo and behold kind of things. So it's a very beautiful book in that way. But she writes that the most emptying kind of moment in her life happened on the 24th of April 2011. She said, both of us, me and my husband, having been with Swami, for physically knowing him, being there for more than 30 years, the biggest kind of void which could never get filled. There was so much of pain. And she kept, you know, wondering what next, you know. What next? She recollects how when her parents had passed away, not her parents actually, her friend's parents had passed away, and Swami was consoling, parent or husband, I don't remember exactly, but when Swami was consoling, Swami said, there is sorrow, there is grief, nothing wrong in venting out that grief, but get over it, don't keep sticking to that only. Yes, take a week, 2 weeks, a month, get over the grief and then get back to normalcy. And so she writes that, I knew I had to get back to normalcy, but how am I to get back to normalcy? There's so much of sorrow. And when this kept happening over and over again, she says, finally, she recollects one episode. Again, see the importance of documenting. She has written it down, and that's why when she goes back and reads, she sees it is there. And just reading that, she says, instantly, all that emptiness just vanished and got replaced with fullness. And what was that episode? She says that somewhere in 2009 or 10, she's in Prashanthi Nilayam,
mm-hmm.
and she's sitting for darshan, and she's very pained to see Swami's physical frame being so frail and weak and in need of assistance. And she was wondering what is happening. So as she's sitting there, Swami is returning back to the Yajurmandir in the car. And that day, Swami stops the car near her, lowers the glass, and beckons to her. She's in the second line or something. She gets up and goes to Swami, and Swami tells her something. She's not able to hear it. Asks again, three times, four times, and finally she partially hears and partially lip reads, and she says at that moment it made absolutely no sense, because after that Swami did exactly the opposite of what he had told. What was it? Swami told her, I am not going anywhere. And immediately after that, he went back home. So she was wondering, what is it? Maybe it was meant for somebody else. But she says, on that day when she was sitting there, totally at her rock bottom, wondering what it is, she goes back and sees this and she says, oh my God, it makes total meaning. So when we wonder whether Sai is all-knowing at all times, it's not only about the past and present, it's about the future too. So many times that is what has happened. In those moments when we feel that Swami is, in quotes, not speaking sense, or Swami is speaking something very tangentially, it is so for us because possibly it's not belonging to the past that we remember or the present. It's possibly a seed for the future which will come and be the most vital, perfect thing for us when we need it. That is what was Diana Baskin's discovery. And I feel that is why Swami says it is a Maya. And the only way to overcome this is to have that absolute faith that this is perfect sense. If I'm not able to make sense of it, that's something lacking in me. It's not something lacking in what Swami has said or done.
And this specific question, I think Professor Nanjundia, former controller of examinations, he had asked the Swami directly. You know, and he would narrate that there was a scene that he would typically see during darshan times, and that was what triggered this thought. That Swami would be going around giving darshan, picking letters, speaking to some people. Sometimes it would happen that Swami would walk past a person, and then he would come back and then interact with that person, or give him vibhuti or something. Almost like, you know, you've missed something or you've forgotten something, and then you've remembered that task and you come back. Right? So, which means there is a point where you forget and then you remember. So, he asked this question to Swami. Swami, is it that you remember everything all the time? You know everything all the time? Well, sometimes you have to call that omniscience and then you act upon that. And Swami literally laughed it out, and then Swami said, I know everything all the time of all people. And almost like a declaration with a lot of emphasis and pause, Swami said that. But the thing is, you know, Swami is always dabbling between this, that Maya aspect and that all-knowing aspect. I remember one of my classmates, he was not from a family of devotees, and he happened to just join, he applied to the university and just got in. And can you believe he's from a place called Madanapalli, which is barely 3 or 4 hours from here.
It's 100 kilometers, less than
and,
that.
Yeah, and he had never seen Swami before. They were not devotees. He's never come to Prashantinilayam. And he just lands up here in Vrindavan, actually. And first day, goes inside Trayi, and he's kind of observing Swami and taking all this inside slowly. So one day Swami calls him and Swami starts speaking to him and Swami asks, where are you from? And he says, Swami, Madanapalli. And Swami was very happy. Oh, Madanapalli, it's just nearby. And, you know, it's a town that Swami must have visited so often. And in fact, it's a very famous town because it's Rabindranath Tagore is supposed to have lived there for a few years. He had a short time that he spent there or something like that.
And I think, it comes very close to even Horsley Hills. And Swami has been to Horsley Hills multiple times.
Exactly. So Swami said, oh, you're from Madanapalli. And then Swami asked, where in Madanapalli you're... Or Swami started asking about his parents and all that. And he was saying, then suddenly Swami asked him, do you know this particular clinic? Swami said a name, I think Sudhakar Hospital or something like that. And this boy was like, yes, Swami, it is. I know where it is because it is quite close to where he lives. Then Swami said, next to that Sudhakar Hospital, there is one road which goes inside. He said, yes, Swami. You go down that road, in that corner, there's one shop or one temple or something, Swami said. He said, yes, Swami. And you take a turn there, the fourth house, yellow gate, isn't that your house? And he was like, just a moment ago, Swami was asking me, where are you from? And just seconds later, Swami is telling me exactly where my house is. And he said, you know, what do you make of this? You know, is he asking you because he doesn't know, or is it just to strike a conversation? And the other episode, which I recall is, I'm sure we must have narrated it before. One of our seniors, he was narrating how after he came to Swami, he was in school at that time. He became a devotee of Swami. And I think the Shankaracharya of Kanchi at that time, who was the head of the Shankara Mutt, he was coming to a temple which was close to where he lived. So his mother came and told him, you know, he's a great Swamiji, you should go and see him. So he said, why should I go and see anybody else? You know, I've seen Swami and I believe in Swami and there's no necessity for us to go to any other guru now. And his mother said, no, you're behaving very arrogant. And she was pretty upset and she went away. So after some time, they realized that he was coming to a school which was next to, closer to where he was living. So then his father came and told, see, your mother insisted that you should come, at least for her sake, why didn't you come? So he said, all right. And he goes, I think he must have been in 9th standard or 8th standard or something like that. And he was in this gathering all the while thinking, what is wrong with these people? You know, they must be knowing that God is there in the human form. Why don't they just direct everybody to him? Mm-hmm. You know, why should they have their own, this kind of paraphernalia and reception and gatherings and all that? And he was like so troubled, you know. He was saying, in all my innocence and all my childish ignorance, I was thinking, why these people are not leading the people who come to them to Swami? And in this huge gathering, this person comes and he comes straight to him, speaks to him, asks him what's your name and all that. Almost like, you know, I know that this is what is troubling you. And then he goes inside that house or school or wherever he had to be. And he comes out he has this huge garland and a crown which they make out of flowers. Mm. Generally they make for, deities and all that. So he had all of this. And this boy was all the more thinking, you know, what is all this? Why should they accept all this? And, you know, what are they doing here? And they're not doing their work of, you know, a guru is supposed to show you to God, right? So they're not doing that. And he was thinking all of that. So again, this Shankaracharya, he comes walking straight to where this boy is, removes this crown, puts it on the boy, removes his garland, puts it on him, and then walks away. Right? Almost like, I'm acknowledging what you're thinking, but it is not my place or it is not my role to do that. Mm-hmm. Right? So that is the sense he got, that I know what you're thinking. I'm also with you in what you're thinking, but you know, this is how things have to be at this point in time. Mm. So this was a very revealing episode that happened. And he was saying that much later he had the opportunity to be in the interview room with Swami. And and for a long time he wanted to narrate this to Swami and kind of get the confirmation, this is what I was thinking and, you know, is this what happened? So at one point, after many, many years, he was alone with Swami and Swami asked, Amy Samacharam, right? That's the time when you can really say something. So he said, Swami, I want to narrate an episode from my school days. And Swami was reading a letter or something and Swami immediately folded everything. Chappu, 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 what is it? Hmm. So he started narrating the whole thing. And like a perfect person, listener, you know, as this boy was narrating the episode, at the right point, Swami was saying, oh, is that so? Did that happen like that? Mm. Oh, you thought like that? Oh, your mother said this? And all of that, you know, Swami was like, and every remark of Swami was enthusing him to, be more elaborate on his narration and whole thing. And he came to the point where the Shankaracharya goes inside and he's thinking all the more, why are they not turning everybody to Swami? At that point, till then, Swami was an eager listener. At that point, Swami says, stop. And the remaining narration, Swami completes it. Swami says, he came like this. Then he parted everybody. He came straight to you. He lifted his crown. He put it on you. This boy was like, 10 minutes I was narrating the whole thing. And Swami was pretending as though he knows nothing and he's enjoying the narration. And here he is literally completing the climax of the whole narration. Right? So, I mean, it is never the case that Swami didn't know or Swami doesn't know. For whatever reason, sometimes the reason is just to give us that opportunity to share to him or, you know, speak to him, narrate or answer or reply. But it's never the case that Swami doesn't know. But it's not easy to hold on to that faith too.
Absolutely, because what we perceive of Swami is nothing but a reflection of what we are. That is why, you know, the great Saint Annamacharya in a Kirtana, he said, Yantamatramuna yavara talachina antamatrame nivu. Whatever, whoever thinks of you as, that's all you are. If people think of you as, in fact the song goes as, if people think of you as Vishnu, you are the Vishnu. If people think of you as Shiva, you are Shiva. Whatever people think of you. And that's why he says, I think of you as my Ramana, Venkat Ramana on the hill and you will be that. So that holds good in every sense. If we think that you know, Swami is all-knowing for about 80% of the time. That's what he will be. 20% of the time,
right.
He'll show you that he is not knowing some things.
And also, I think there is a difference between ignorance and being guileless and being specifically, you know, you kind of misuse that idea that Swami doesn't know. And I think at those times, Swami plays along. Swami allows you to believe that you don't know, and that's a really a dangerous track to go down on.
I often think of this like, you know, as my daughter is growing now, she comes and she tells me, do you know what happened to Jarasandha? I know fully well what happened. But I say, no, what happened? And she says, oh, I would love to see that expression of joy. And because she's getting joy narrating it, I get joy in acting ignorant. I feel that must be the same with Bhagwan. Absolutely, as a normal parent, if I can feel this, how will the divine parent be feeling? Oh, yes. I mean, when we come and tell Swami, you know, Shankaracharya, for him, it will be that only. You know, when we tell this Bhashyam, that Bhashyam, Advaita, Swami listens and encourages. He has Kavi Sammelan. He is a Kavi Naam Kavi. He is a poet among poets. And yet, he calls for everybody to tell poetry in different languages. And, you know, some of us have stood up and ejected out some kind of rhymes, and yes, we have received appreciation. So that is the divine parent showering his love. Because as Swami says, he continues to say, he says, there is no desire in Sai. There is total purity only. This entire body is Amrit, nectar. Where is there space for desire in Sai? Everything is already mine. Sai does not think. My will is immediately realized. Whatever it may be, it instantly appears. An envelope, gold, everything. Where is there room for desire? I have no thought. If I think, it is for you. It is not for me. Sai requires no food. If I eat, it is for the benefit of everyone. If I give darshan, it is not for me. It is for others. I am talking to you now. It is for you, not for me. A point does not appear in Swami at all. First a point, then disappoint. I am always the same. I am love, always love. If there are angry words, that is action. Inwardly I remain the same. I have the same tender love for that person. So Swami says that there is no desire. You know, I think also because it is, you know, that famous equation Swami gives us. Swami says, man minus desire becomes God. Which means it is only the desires that stand between man and divinity. Removal of desires makes you divine. So if somebody is asking whether you are all-knowing, you are divine all the times or sometime, Swami is making it clear that there is no desire at all. If there is no desire at all, it is divinity only all the time. If there is some desire coming in, then you become a mortal. But when there is no desire, and Swami even specifically says, if you think that I am eating it for others' benefit. And on a few occasions, I have literally seen this, where the host is begging and pleading with Swami to eat. You know, when we had traveled with Swami to Delhi, at one devotee's home where we had been, at the end of a long, grueling day, we were all ravenous. And, you know, as we entered the dining area, plates had been arranged for us, the aroma that was coming. Oh my God, the juices in the stomach got ready, that some delicious feast is coming. And physically, Swami was in our sight all the while, except when he traveled in the car from that venue to the devotee's home. So Swami too has not had anything other than water, possibly warm water. And then the tasty dishes were laid out before Swami. We do Brahmarpanam, and once Swami starts, only we start. And Swami is barely eating. And we were all gorging on the food, and the host had to force Swami, and Swami ate, I think, one puri maybe and a little bit. And really, I felt that Swami, you're eating for their sake. They will feel bad if you don't eat. That's why you have no need for the food. You know, speaking of which, I'm reminded of an episode that Dr. Narendranath Reddy narrates multiple times. I think it was 1993 or 94 when Swami had called their whole family in for an interview. And during that interview, you know, Dr. Advi Reddy, who is Dr. Narendra Reddy's father, he was telling Swami about how in the Himalayas, the yogis who are there, they don't eat anything at all and they derive their energy from the elements directly. So he turned to Swami and said, Swami, you also don't eat anything at all. You also must be doing that only, right? Deriving energy from the elements. Instantly Swami replied, no, the elements derive their energy from me. So that is what Swami is. It is not as if he needs to derive energy from food or directly from the elements, or, you know, there is a Sanskrit term for that, you know, those who eat air. I forget it. I think Vayu Bhaksha or something like that. They can just eat air and live on it because there are atoms that are synthesized into food. It's none of those. Swami is the energizer of the whole universe, and therefore Swami says, whatever I do, if I walk, it's for love for you. If I eat food, it is out of love for you. If I speak, it's love for you. If I listen to your narration and act like I don't know, that's also out of love for you.
Beautiful. I think this one paragraph, Swami, is literally condensed the essence of Swami's nature, and so very profound. And I can only imagine how it would have been to listen to this entire thing from Swami. And Swami says, I don't have any desire. Whatever I do it for you. And I think this is what we keep forgetting whenever we see Swami. And it needs a very, very, extended period of time to really look at Swami for one to understand that this is how Swami is. He is absolutely untouched by whatever is around him. And I think there was a very beautiful discourse Swami was talking, I think, in the context of health. And in that, Swami was saying, now, Swami's food never changes. You know, a poor man might call Swami, a prince might call Swami, a farmer might call Swami. What Swami eats is always the same only. Mm. Right? And looking at it from the point of view of a human approach to food, if you see it that way, right? The divine approach, as you're saying, is Swami derives all energy. The elements derive all energy from Swami. That is the divine aspect of Swami. And that is, in fact, the essence of what the Vedas say. That it is like, you know, all the elements that you see, they are all strung together by this divine energy which is running through all of them. So in that sense, this is the Vedic declaration that Swami is saying. But even in the human approach, you see, Swami is like so untouched by anything that is around Swami. And one day it is there, one day it is not there. It really doesn't touch Swami at all. And that's why if you very superficially look at Swami, there's a lot of scope for misunderstanding. And one day Swami comes and asks something, one day Swami says something that totally is meaningless and totally is unrelated to what is happening, as Diana Baskin had documented. But nothing is without purpose, nothing is without a deeper sense.
No, I was reading another brother's personal diary. He's been sharing it as a blog, our own colleague, Brother Harinanda Kumar. And in his blog during one Kodai visit, I was reading, and it's very, very profound. He's, of course, documented his thoughts also along with what has happened. So there's this one particular boy whom apparently every session Swami is asking, what's your name, what's your name? And this boy keeps telling, and he says the fifth time Swami asked, he told out his name, like, suppose, let's say his name is Ramesh Anand. I'm just saying something like that. Ramesh Anand, Swami? You know, like, how can you forget? I've told you five times like that. And he says, see, in this way, without even us knowing, possibly this is how we get trapped in Maya or whatever. We think that Swami is asking how he forgot. It is so easy. You know, sitting here, thinking of the episodes in the past, we can possibly think, how is it that they could, how could they forget Swami's God? But with Swami around, it's, you know, Swami has the ability to, as you said, part the clouds and make that, oh my God, whose presence are we in? That feeling to get aroused in you. Or sometimes he just makes it like, hey, he's one among us, man. He's, that feeling he has given to the princes, to the paupers, to people from Telangana, to villagers, everybody, you know, they've all felt Swami is one among us. And that is the reason everybody dives and jumps and comes to him, because he's ours. That is the feeling that they get. So in such a moment, without us even realizing, we forget that. So it is not as if, even when people say that he's all-knowing sometimes only and not all times, it is not with any other agenda that they're saying it. It's just that human mind and human beings are like that, that in that casual moment we just forget. And it doesn't appear at all that, you know, we come out and say, is this God? No, he's a very loving friend. He's a very loving mother. That's what you feel. So that's what it is. At this point, dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break. And on the other side of the break, continue with this conversation.
Welcome back, dear listeners. And before you wonder, the New Year song, yes, it was performed on a New Year, and that's why it ends with Happy New Year. It's not that this is New Year for anybody, because in India you have so many New Years that it might be someone's New Year. Coming back to this beautiful conversation that we're just going through. The one which we completed is where Swami speaks about his own nature in a very profound and deep manner. The next question that Hislop asks is a little more general, general philosophical question. He says, Swami, some tragedy happens to a person and they try to find a reason for it in the actions of this lifetime. Mm. Swami says, yes, that can be. Hislop then asks, but I thought that all that happens in this life is the result of our behavior in the past existence. Swami says, not always. Some things could happen with its cause in this life. So a short discussion on karma. I think this again is a question that a lot of people ask. Even when we were doing the satsang on karma, a lot of people had asked this question. Is it always only past karmas that come? Or sometimes the same karma, especially when somebody else is doing wrong, we want this question to be answered. You know, will that person face the music within this lifetime, or will it happen at some lifetime and I'm not going to be there around to witness it?
Watch and enjoy it.
Right.
I think we also recently got a mail asking the same question as to what if A cuts off B's hand, will it be that in the next birth B will come and cut off A's hand? So the answer to that mail, as well as what Swami is saying here, it's just impossible almost, or at least very, very, very difficult to understand the specifics of the working of karma. This is what I have done, either good or bad. How is it going to come back to me? Is it going to come back in this birth? Who is going to mete it out to me? All these are specifics which are very difficult to understand, and that's why even in that entire satsang that we did, which is there on YouTube, I think we did in two parts. The entire thing about karma is there are some basic guidelines which are always true. Specifics are impossible to tell. It is true that good you do, as you sow, so shall you reap. It is true that whatever you do, you're going to get the result. And when it is going to come, whether it's going to be an immediate result or it'll take many years, and what you're facing now, is it an action that is happening, or is it a reaction to something that you've already done? All these are almost impossible to find out, and that's why we should not bother about it, because they're not in our hands. What is in our hand is what can be done now, and that's why I think we just remember the basic principles of karma without trying to understand the specifics of how that works.
Right, but I think just that Swami is saying that it is not wrong to introspect when something goes wrong, because I think that's what Hislop first says, that when there's some tragedy, you try to look into your own life. And Swami is saying there's nothing wrong in that, and it can be done, and any kind of self-introspection. In fact, I always used to think of this when Swami would suddenly stop speaking in the hostel. That'll always trigger the self-introspection. All of us will become silent and we'll start becoming a little better version of ourselves. And I used to always think of that, the very opportunity to be in Swami's presence. Even if Swami comes and says Dunnapota or Bangaru or whatever it is, that one statement, you would have earned it through many, many lifetimes of good karma. As we were just talking about Mr. Venu Srinivasan, he was narrating that episode where he was traveling in Swami's car. Swami was going to the music college and he was with Swami, and suddenly he was overwhelmed with that thought. He said, Swami, I don't know how many, which Janmas Punya I am there in your present. And Swami looked at him and said, Janma, Janmas and Janmas, Swami said, right? So just that one moment in Swami's presence is earned through many, many lifetimes. But at the same time, one day Swami doesn't speak to you, you start correcting your day on, your present, as that is going to matter for the next day. Because I used to think that it doesn't matter, if I be a good boy for one day, how can I earn that fortune of Swami coming and speaking to me the next day? But nevertheless, the present correction that you do through self-introspection is always good. So that should never be given up, and I think that's what Swami is acknowledging, that yes, if there's something going wrong, look at your own life, take stock, and if there's any correction that needs to be done, there's nothing wrong in doing that.
Going ahead, Hislop asks, Swami, please restate or redefine the goal, the objective of the American Satya Sai organization. Very, very specific question. And he's also asking to restate and redefine, possibly because I think last week or sometime also we had seen where he had asked Swami, what should American Satya Sai organization do? So he is now asking, please redefine, restate, and American Satsai organization, not general, don't speak generally. And Swami says, it is not just the American, it is the objective for the worldwide Satyasai organizations. So I think, you know, we should all open our ears now, because Swami is telling this is universal. What is it? People the world over do not know they are divine. They do not even realize what it is to be human. They have ego, anger, greed, envy, lust, and hatred. These are not human qualities, they are animal qualities. Unless Sai devotees are, at the very least, human persons free of animal qualities or characteristics, how can such devotees suggest spiritual life to others? Such suggestions will have no impact if devotees in general are not yet free from animal characteristics. There should be in each Satya Sai Baba center two or three members who live a life as true human beings. So becomes very, very clear that the objective of the Satsai organization, be it in America, in Guatemala, Sri Lanka, in Asia, Africa, wherever, the objective is to divinize oneself, to become divine. But there is an intermediate step before that, because Swami says you have to move to the divine from being human. But first you have to become human. People exhibit all these negative traits and are as bad as animals. And therefore, I think for practical purposes, we can summarize the goal of the worldwide Satsai organizations is to move from animality to being human, and from being human to the level of the divine.
No, absolutely. And the thing is, Swami is making it so very down to earth. You know, Swami said that the goal of the international organization is to spread Swami's name to every nook and corner. Or if Swami had said that, you know, every person who's coming should become spiritually evolved or something like that, or should reach Atma Sakshatkar. I mean, that would have made it so very difficult. The whole idea of Swami saying is, can you march towards idealism? Can you make yourself a better person? And can you make the organization a space where people can come and strive to be that? Right? I think that's all Swami is saying. Because that's all an organization can do. Anything else has to be done between the individual and Swami. There's nothing the organization set up, a central trust, an institute. It could be even the Satyasai Institute of High Learning, but can only give you a platform. It can give you an environment where you can come and strive. But the striving should be done by the individual, and the blessing should be given by Swami. There's nobody else who can do anything. And I think that's so very beautifully and categorically mentioned in this simple answer that Swami gives.
At the same time, it's not only about each individual's uplift. It's not like the platform is there. Now I come here and try to gain maximum what I can, because Swami continues to say, the individual does not progress alone. He is not separate from society, and he must do his bit to uplift the society. Therefore, the individual's work to free himself from animal characteristics and to live a spiritual life is not done for himself, but is done for all of God's creatures. The work of freeing the individual's nature from animal qualities is done in love for God and done in his name, and with his help. It reminds one of a quote that Swami Vivekananda would say often, which is, Atmano Mokshartam Jagat Hitayacha. Meaning, individual moksha, at the same time Jagat Hita, meaning the welfare of the world. You progress, you work for your own salvation, at the same time ensuring the welfare and well-being of the entire world.
Exactly. And I think in a sense, when we say that it is for individual progress, the kind of individual progress that Swami is speaking of is defined by Atmano Mokshartam Jagat Hitayacha. Because each one of us are selfish by nature. Each one of us are interested in our own progress. But the spiritual progress that Swami is speaking of is best defined by saying that even as you're progressing, you will find that you're becoming more and more useful to the people around. You are becoming more and more instrumental in the progress of others, which means that is spiritual progress, which means you are progressing in the manner that you need to be progressing. I think, and at the same time, Swami is also making it clear that don't hold yourself responsible for the other's progress. It will automatically happen, but it is not defined by, your role is not defined by the progress that others are undergoing.
Going ahead, Swami says, each member of the Satya Sai Center should work very hard to purify the quality of his life. And the goal should be to lead a perfect life, an ideal life, to be an ideal exemplar of the divine teachings of Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. The world will respond to the ideal life of a Sai devotee. The world will respond to the ideal life of a Sai devotee. The world is yearning for the ideal life and will on its own accord adopt such a life if it comes into view. They will respond and will follow such a life. So the way forward, Swami is saying, is to be, not by telling, don't tell others what they should do. Be what you're supposed to be. That is as per Swami's teachings, and do as per that. Once you be and do, automatically people will see, get inspired and follow. That has been Swami's method as well, Swami has definitely told in his discourses to control anger, to control greed, to control ego. But when you see the divine humility, when you see the way Swami is and the way Swami conducts his actions, you automatically get inspired. You get inspired into making sacrifices. You get inspired into, having more restraint and having more forbearance. All these are inspired. You start doing it not because Swami told you to do it, but because you got inspired seeing Swami, and Swami is saying that is how it should be done. The goal of the Satsai organization is that everybody should become divine, but that message should not be propagated by speaking. It should be by, as Swami says, a few members at least practicing it, to move from animality to humanity, and from that to start practicing divine values, virtues and values, so that one day all our nature will become divine.
Right, and the way Swami is putting it here, I think it's very important that the inspiration part, others looking at you, that will automatically happen. That need not be your burden. That need not be something that you should be worried about.
Mm.
Because I think a youngster once asked this question in one of the satsangs. He said, how do I be an instrument? And I'm not a singer, I'm not a speaker, how do I be an instrument? Because we always think that to be observed is the only way by which you can be an instrument. If you're in a position where somebody can hear you, somebody can, you're a singer and somebody is following you, or somebody, you're on a platform and people are able to observe you. Actually, it really doesn't matter even that much. One of our former professors, Dr. Sainath, used to tell us that when Swami had called their batch for an interview, I think they were graduating and Swami had called them for an interview. And one of the questions that the students had asked there was, Swami, how do we apply Swami's teachings and whatever we have learned from Swami's presence to change the world? Right? Because we are now going out, and how do we, what is the most effective way to take Swami's message to the world? And Swami's simple answer was, don't even try that. Swami said, don't even try to change the world. You'll fail miserably and you'll only be disappointed, and you would have wasted a good part of your life. Swami said, take whatever you have received from Swami and change your life. That is all you need to be bothered about. Nothing more than that. 10 people will, without your knowledge, look at you and they will be inspired and they will change. Swami said, don't even be bothered about how the world is going to change and how you are going to be a change agent. None of that is your botheration. And as I said, that will happen automatically. And Swami is very clearly saying here, the Satya Sai organization is not meant to change the world. It is only meant to change individuals. And automatically, when the individuals transform the right manner, the social transformation also has to happen. That is part of how Swami has made the whole thing.
So Hislop asks, Swami, does that mean that our centers should now move beyond the task of working with center members and tackle the world? Swami says, the center members must carefully work to become truly human before they venture to instruct the world. At this point, dear listeners, we'll take another little break, because the subject is changing here, and on the other side of the break, continue with this conversation. Welcome back, dear listeners. The conversation continues and I'm sorry. The conversation, as I said before the break, took a break there and it's like a new conversation here. And Swami is asking, how do you like the pictures? So he's showing some pictures to Hislop and these are, as Hislop records, portrait pictures for the college building to be dedicated on the 23rd. So for the college building, these pictures are there and these are the pictures of Robert Bozzani and his wife, Barbara Bozzani. So, Robert Bozzani, who is there in the interview, he says, we were afraid they'll be too large. And Swami says, they are not too large. Swami's picture will be the same size. Do you like the pictures? And Hislop says, Bozzani looks like a movie star. Swami says, no, no, he's smiling. Whereas Mrs. Bozzani is more serious. Come, sit down. So, I think it has always been like this. You know, in Vrindavan, it's called the Walter Cohen block. Right. And whoever has contributed, it is divine love that Swami...
This is one Essensing block, right? That's the hostel.
Yes. Walter Cohen block is a hostel. Essensing is the side one.
Okay.
And then we have, of course, the Purnachandra Auditorium, the Sai Kulwant Hall, the Ramesh Hall, Sai Ramesh Hall. Then there's a Gulab Kunwarba block, the Nasin Mishan Auditorium.
There's one Manunmani Nursing College.
Nursing, yes, based on... yes, that is... See, this is what it is. I feel when the divine shows gratitude, how humbling it is. Why can't we show gratitude? That is the thing, we get inspired. That is the way Swami's life is. And even, you know, Swami would... Robert Bozzani, Swami would call as Bob Bozzani. And his life is amazing, as he says in an interview. He says that I had a house by the beach. I had my boat in the harbor. I drove a Porsche. I had a beautiful, lovely wife. I still have her, he says. I have three wonderful children. And I wanted to die. You know, it's so anticlimactic. And he says, this is how my life was. And he says, I never got suicidal thoughts, but I was so dissatisfied and unhappy inside. And whatever I did, you know, he had a flourishing business. I think they made trailer homes and something like that, transportation. And it was all doing very well, but he was just not happy. And he says that he realized how unhappy he was when at one point of time his partner called him and said, you know, he had just returned home after a 1 hour drive from work, and his partner calls and says, no, come back, there's some amazing thing. And he says, okay, I'm not interested, let me be there. He says, no, no, come, come, come. And he's so enthused, the partner. And finally he says, don't you want to be very, very rich? Okay, and then Mr. Bozzani starts his car. He says, okay, I'll come. And he starts driving. And he says, throughout that 1 hour drive back to work, I kept thinking, no, I don't want to be rich. I don't want to be rich. I don't want to be rich. He says, we went there. The deal was done within 10 minutes, successful. The partner was extremely happy. But he says, as I drove back home also, I kept thinking this only, no, I don't want to be rich. I don't want to be rich. I don't want to be rich. It became like a mantra. So much of dissatisfaction, he says. And it's a very interesting way in which through the yoga classes of Indira Devi, you know, they happened to visit India. And he says, the first time I saw Swami, he says, Swami comes near him and, you know, puts his hand on his chest, just rubs it up and down and says, so much unhappiness, so much unhappiness, so much unhappiness. And he's so relieved. You know, in my eagerness to tell this, I just forgot to say, what happens is, when he is very unhappy, once he says in his bedroom after his wife has slept, Swami appears in his bedroom. And it's not a dream. And Swami is there in a white robe, but having the voice of his late father.
Mm-hmm.
And tells, child, don't worry. Everything will be fine. The amazing thing I felt was, after this, he didn't feel like I have to go and see the Satya Sai Baba. You know? He said, okay, nice. But he said, I felt good, but there was nothing about that. But then, his wife was the one who was instrumental in, you know, saying, no, Indra Devi is saying, let's go, we have to go and pull. And he said that, see, I'm going to come and I'm going to tour and enjoy Bangalore. I'm not interested in all this. I was just wondering, how is it that you have been visited by a being in your bedroom and such a jaw-dropping miracle? That's why I feel, you know, Swami says, miracles are just my calling cards. That is not, because what I think is going to stun me, hardly had any impact on Mr. Bob Bozani. But then he says, during that interview, no, he said, Swami said three things. One is that God belongs to all. God is for all. And the second thing is, Jesus came on earth. He says, but God came on earth, yes, as Jesus. He can keep coming again and again whenever he wants. And then, God is not upset which name or form of his you worship. He says, these three statements were the exact three answers to the question that had tormented me from Catholic school since I was a 10-year-old. And you know, to my amazement, he says, when Swami said this, I knew that he's God. I'm thinking, he came in your room, man, in America, and you didn't feel he's God. That's what it is. It is a, you know, the way different people come to, you know, as a artha or artharti, you come as an artha and your pain is relieved and you feel he's God. You come as an artharti and you're conferred wealth and you feel he's God. You come as a jignyasu, you get your answer and you're convinced. It's not that miracle. So possibly he came as a jignyasu to Swami, because he says that even his wife, who was actually instrumental in pulling him and bringing him to Swami, said that for 2 years, she just felt Swami is a guru. He's a wonderful master. It's only 2 years later that she came and confessed that, you know, finally I feel that he is divine. I know who he is. But imagine what she didn't get. He got it. He said instantly, the minute Swami said these three statements, it answered the three questions that had been bothering me. He was divine. You know, so I think later he went on to even, yeah, construct the college building as it's written there. And so in the entrance, there are these two photographs, and looks like on that day Swami was showing the photo, and how do you think he looks?
Right. And I think that's the beauty of, it's not merely Swami naming the block after that person or putting a photograph. It's that involvement. You know, it's like, I'm not doing this just because you gave me some money and I'm supposed to do it. You can kind of sense the joy with which Swami is doing it. Swami is saying, no, you know, my picture is also going to be the same size. I'm also going to put my thing there and you'll be there. And so happy. And like one of the old students was once narrating, Swami had promised to perform the 60th anniversary of his parents' wedding, or, you know, the father's 60th birthday is usually celebrated as the 60th Shashtiyat Purti. And they called that.
Purti,
right? Yeah. And Swami had said that I will bless them and I'll do all that. And I think on the day Swami was to give them an interview, that morning Swami sends Mr. Kutumbrao with a sari and the dhoti and all of that to be given to the couple so that they can get dressed and come to the mandir in that. So he comes and he hands over those gifts that Swami has sent. And then Mr. Kutumbrao tells the family, he says, Amma, you should know this. Swami spent almost an hour trying to choose this sari for you.
Mm.
Right? And Swami was like pulling out everything. Swami used to have these almirahs where he used to keep all these clothes which he used to distribute. He's saying that Swami stood there, he was getting every one of the sari pulled, and Swami was saying, no, this will not suit her skin color. This is not good. No, this is too grand. She will not like it. She has three saris in this color, so don't want this. You know, to that extent, right? And, you know, you can only imagine how beautiful it would have been. I think that's the touch that Swami would always give. You know, as you said, one hand, Swami can appear in your living room. Swami could appear in your locked bedroom and speak to you. Swami could answer questions that have been troubling you for so many years. And with all of this, it's that Swami that who's saying that, you know, are you looking good at this picture? I'm going to put it up. So I think that is, all of this together is what Swami is made of, and that's what makes Swami who he is.
He is the central core of everything. As the discussion ahead also is around that only. I mean, unless you are at the center of everything, you won't be omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent like that. And interestingly, that's where the conversation also goes. Because Swami himself initiates this saying, at the center, everything is liquid. And Robert Bozzani is asking, does Swami mean the world? Because, you know, from the photograph, suddenly Swami is saying, at center, everything is liquid. So, Swami, you're meaning the world? Yes, everything is melted. No temperature. And then Bozzani asks, no heat, Swami? You know, natural, because, you know, whatever we read, even now if we search and read, the Earth's core is supposed to be 4,500 right. to 6,000 degrees Celsius. And Swami is telling there's no temperature. And Swami emphasizes and says, no temperature. Everything is liquid, like water. Gold, iron, silver, gems, all are liquid. Next, there is solid. Then trees. Hislop says, trees, Swami? Trees like we see around us. I think Hislop is imagining that Swami is saying that buried inside are trees.
Mm-hmm.
But what Swami is saying is different. Swami is saying in the core it is liquid. The next layer is solid. On that solid layer, which we consider as the earth crust, are the trees. Because Swami says, yes, trees. Then human beings and animals. At the very center is the divine. It is a support of everything. First is liquid, chemistry. Then solid, physics. Then trees, botany. Then man, you know. The pinnacle of life. But at the center, supporting all, is the divine. Without the divine, where is chemistry, physics, botany? This will be the teaching of all courses at the university. The students will understand the full picture. So, just some time back, Swami laid out the vision for the Satsai organization. And here Swami is saying, what should be there at the Satsai Institute of Higher Learning? It should be higher learning. They should understand the full picture and not just physics, chemistry, biology. Because Swami says you should understand the integration between chemistry, physics and biology. At the core is chemistry. I feel good having done chemistry.
Interestingly, I was very delighted to read this conversation because I recall one of our lecturers said that this was the interview which actually led to the structuring of the various departments in the university.
Okay.
It was after this interview where Swami says in the core there is liquid.
Chemistry.
Liquid is rasayana. Rasa, and Rasayana Vidya is the Telugu word, translation for chemistry. So Swami said then there's chemistry and beyond that is matter physics. And material physics. And the last is botany.
That's why the floors in the university.
Right, floors in the university is made like that. And now when Swami is saying that, you know, below all of this is God, interestingly, our foyer is actually in the basement, so to say, in the university. It's a little, a level lower than all the ground floor departments. So, apparently, the engineers who were there in the interview, they came back and said that, so this is how it should be made. So, it's very beautiful that, the building infrastructure itself reflects the message that Swami wanted that should be conveyed through the university to the students.
And, you know, my mind was again pulled to that fact when Swami says, to the fact that Swami is saying there's no temperature, no heat.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to wrap my mind around, I didn't understand. So, I'm just thinking that this is something that in the future years to come, we will understand and then we will look back and say, wow, what Swami? For us, it is another Maya moment, possibly, to think that what is Swami saying here? It's so hot there, 6,000 degrees and Swami is saying it's no temperature. But that is a mystery for the future to decode. We will go ahead with the conversation. Hislop says, in this picture, Swami, where do the devas and demigods and those other creatures of the cosmos fit into? Swami said, they are above the senses. Man is below the senses. Those others are above the senses. Hislop, but all must come to the humans in order to merge with God. Is it not? Is it not so? And Swami says, no, not totally so. There is love. Then can man make a further step and go into the world beyond, world above the senses? Swami says, that is possible. But is it not possible to realize the self or merge with God while in the human state? And Swami says, oh yes, that can be done. Hislop, does Swami mean that both possibilities exist, that man could go one way or the other? And Swami says, yes, one way or the other. Then what makes the difference? What is the difference in man that he would make one choice or the other? And Robert Bozzani adds, that is what I want to know too. And Swami gives the answer as, love is the dominant reason. Compassionate love is pure love, unselfish. In the animal there is love, but it is mixed with lust. But compassion is pure love. Only man has compassion. Though through love he may realize the oneness of life, and in this way, by love, he will be one with God.
Right, and it's a very interesting conversation. Based on that hierarchy that Swami gave about rasa and matter, and then human life and other organic living, sentient beings and all of that. And Hislop asked, what about the devas and devatas and all the other non-physical beings that we often read about in all the scriptures? So Swami clearly makes a distinction that, you know, the senses are the line that distinguishes humans and people in the world from them. Below the senses and above the senses, Swami says.
And how we have the visible and invisible spectrum of light.
Right. And I think in one of the Vahinis, again, Swami speaks extensively about these different lokas, the 14 lokas. Mm. Swami used to take delight in rattling out all of them.
Atala, vitala, sutala, right. Rasatala, patala, talatala.
Exactly. Yeah. And Swami used to say that these are all different vibrations of existence, where in different thought levels people are there. And the conversation is quite interesting, where Swami says that from the human level you actually have a choice. This again, I don't know exactly where I've read, Swami must have said it in one of the discourses, where Swami speaks about some of the beings that choose to come back into the earth. Hmm. And what we would otherwise refer to as karana janmas, as Swami would say, you know, they come with a specific purpose. So when Swami says your love is what that defines it, so there are, Swami would say that some people would want to come back into the world so that they're able to help others who are struggling in the same manner. Probably that's what Swami is speaking about when Swami says that love will decide that, you know, whether it is the love for God that you want to go into a higher plane, into some other loka, Vaikuntha or Kailasha or whatever it is, or you have this sense of compassion towards beings in the world that you want to come and benefit them in some manner by taking a, you know, form as a guru or whatever it is. I mean, not sure whether that is exactly what Swami is referring to, but maybe that is something that Swami is hinting at.
In fact, going ahead, Swami actually dilates a bit more about what is this love and what is the difference between the love as we understand and the true love. But I think we don't have time for that discussion, and therefore the discussion will have to wait for at least a fortnight, because the next couple of weeks will be our Sanatana Sarathi Satsang. So dear listeners, we will be concluding it on this note, leaving a question unanswered as to what is this love. But Swami says through love, everything is possible. We hope that you have enjoyed this discussion as much as we enjoyed it. Thinking about Swami, speaking about Swami, that is the most beautiful thing we can do with our lives. That is one of the best ways to sanctify our times. And we are grateful to Swami for having given us this opportunity. On that note, we will end with a song, on the other side of which you will be greeted by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
Sadhya Sai Janani, Prema Amruta Daini. చేరాము కన్న తల్లి ప్రేమలో కరగిపోయాము ఏ దివ్య వరము నీ చేయి పట్టి నడిచాము ఏ దివ్య వరము నీ చేయి పట్టి నడిచాము సాయి ప్రేమ వాటలో తొలి అడుగులు వేశాము సాయి ప్రేమ వాటలో తొలి అడుగులు వేశాము శాంతిదాయి ప్రేమామృతదాయిని సత్య సాయి జననీ ప్రేమామృతదాయిని.